The gospel, according to Matthew, begins with the genealogy of Jesus, tracing his lineage from Abraham all the way to Joseph, before describing how Joseph is convinced by an angel to marry his pregnant fiancée and adopt her unborn child as his own. Chapter 1 of this gospel ends. When Joseph awoke from sleep, he did as the angel of the Lord commanded him. He took her as his wife, but had no marital relations with her until she had given birth to a son, and he named him Jesus. And then, without any mention of a census, a stable, or shepherds abiding in the fields, chapter 2 of this gospel launches into a story of political intrigue and unthinkable violence by providing the where and the when of the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem during the reign of a king named Herod. Herod the Great ruled over Judea, Galilee, and Samaria, as well as some neighboring territories, for 35 years. He was known for spectacular building projects and ruthless paranoia. He put his own stamp on the temple in Jerusalem and built massive fortresses like Masada and Herodium. He also had one of his wives and two of his sons put to death as part of his effort to eradicate all of his enemies. Even though he was not Jewish, Herod had been appointed by Rome and named by them as King of the Jews, which is why he was so disconcerted when some strangers from a foreign land showed up asking about a newborn king. This gospel never identifies the visitors as kings. It never says how many of them showed up, or even if all of them were men. It simply calls them magi, as in magicians, astrologers, soothsayers, priests of some foreign religion, we don't know. But the author of this gospel sees them as the fulfillment of promises that were made throughout the Jewish scriptures. Back when Abraham was called by God, he was promised that the whole world would be blessed through him and his descendants. When Israel was rescued from slavery and established as a nation, the promise was that by following God's guidance, they would bring blessing to the whole world. Psalm 72 imagines this blessing happening because the rulers of Israel offer justice to the poorest and most helpless of the people. The king of Israel was to administer God's justice. He was to protect the poor and the weak from those who would try to oppress them. Doing so would bring so much prosperity to the nation that foreign kings would be compelled to submit to him, not because of any military might, but because he delivers the poor who cry out in distress, the oppressed and those who have no helper. Sadly, very few of the rulers of the Jewish people ever tried to live up to these ideals. The Old Testament prophets blamed the destruction caused to their people by the great empires of Assyria and Babylon on the injustice and the evil of the kings of Israel and Judah. When, after 70 years of exile, the people were permitted to return home, they faced a difficult and uncertain future as an insignificant part of the Persian Empire. Foreigners now ruled over them. There was widespread poverty and corruption. And it was during those dark and troubled times that the prophet Isaiah encouraged the people to live as if a new age had dawned, to remember that they were still God's chosen nation, destined to bring blessing to the rest of the world. It was a vision of future possibilities and not a prediction. Isaiah's words were never literally fulfilled, but all of his language about kings and camels and gifts of gold and frankincense have certainly colored and influenced our images of the Magi, turning them into we three kings of Orient are. What's important, though, for the Gospel of Matthew is that these foreign visionaries who are not part of the people of Israel and who know nothing of the Jewish scriptures, they are brought by God to worship Jesus. God speaks to them in ways that they understand in order to draw them to worship and into a relationship. When, at the end of this gospel, Jesus commissions his followers to go and make disciples of all nations, he knows that they are going to have to follow the example given by God in calling the Magi. They will have to speak of the God of Israel, the God of promises made at the dawn of human history, in new and innovative ways that will resonate with people. The letter to the Ephesians probably wasn't written by the Apostle Paul, but it is certainly inspired by him and by the commission he received from God to bring the gospel to the non-Jewish people of the Roman Empire. At first, Paul had seen the Christian religion as some kind of blasphemy until a dramatic encounter with the resurrected Christ completely changed his understanding of God. Inspired by his missionary work in Turkey and Greece, the letter to the Ephesians describes Jesus as the fulfillment of God's promises and of God's desire to unite and to reconcile all of creation. What this letter calls the mystery of Christ is the fact that God took on human flesh so that God could offer precious human blood and die a human death. By a miracle that we cannot comprehend, God's willingness to die for the undeserving is the power that heals all of the harm that has been done to creation by human beings and by hostile spiritual forces that this letter refers to as the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. While we may not hold that understanding of some kind of cosmic warfare, we recognize that there are forces in the world that want us divided into camps that are isolated by fear. There are forces that only want to use power to crush perceived enemies and reward uncritical friends. As some of the first people who have been drawn out of this cosmic darkness into the light, the Christian church is called and it is compelled to present a better alternative to the world. A community in which all voices are heard and all people are respected. A community that trusts in God's power to bring unlimited blessing and unlimited justice to the whole world. A community in which people of all races and cultures, all genders and understandings of gender, all political parties and all social ideologies learn to work together in order to discern and to create a common good grounded in the unconditional love of God. We must be the wise men and women who recognize that God is already at work in the world around us, so that we can use words and deeds that resonate with people's deepest spiritual desires. We are the ones who need to shine with a light that attracts, invites, and guides people into the love of God.